This is the Quality News Network. On her way to the Middle East, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice made an unexpected stop in Beirut. She met with Lebanon's prime minister and thanked him for his courage. But she also told him that Hezbollah must withdraw from southern Lebanon before a ceasefire can be called, and said an international force should be deployed there instead. But a Lebanese official rejected the proposals. He said a ceasefire must come before any other actions take place. Rice also discussed sending humanitarian aid to Lebanon, with supplies expected to begin arriving in Cyprus soon. They'll be delivered by non-governmental relief organizations rather than the U.S. military. But President Bush has ordered U.S. helicopters and ships to help in the effort. The U.N. is calling for $150 million in aid to the Lebanese. The agency estimates that 500,000 residents have been forced from their homes. And U.S. officials say nearly 12,000 Americans have now been evacuated from Lebanon. On the Israel-Lebanon border, fierce fighting continued today. Israeli forces captured two Hezbollah guerrillas, and Hezbollah fired 90 rockets into Israel. Two Israeli soldiers were killed in fighting, and two other Israeli soldiers were killed when their helicopters accidentally crashed on the Israeli side. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will travel to Washington, D.C. tomorrow to meet with President Bush. They're expected to discuss adding more U.S. and Iraqi troops to help stop the rising violence. U.S. officials say one option is to move coalition forces operating in other parts of the country into Baghdad, which is bearing the brunt of the violence. In Washington, Democrats say they will fight John Bolton's appointment as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. President Bush appointed him on a temporary basis last year, but his term expires in January. A Senate committee is expected to hold a confirmation hearing on Thursday. In California, a heat wave may force the state into a power emergency with the potential of more blackouts. At least four deaths are being blamed on this weekend's heat, which reached triple digits in some areas yesterday. Also in California, firefighters are battling in record heat to contain a 6,600-acre wildfire east of San Diego. And off the California coast, another blaze burned 700 acres on Catalina Island. In Idaho, three forest fires are raging, driven by high temperatures and wind. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
Global trade talks in Geneva fell apart today after leading countries failed to agree on opening up farm and manufactured goods trade. India's trade minister says that could set back negotiations by years. A group of investors plans to purchase HCA Incorporated, the largest for-profit hospital chain in the U.S. The group will assume nearly $12 billion in debt in the $21 billion deal. And Advanced Micro Devices is buying ATI Technologies in a more than $5 billion deal. The parent company of United Airlines is expected to post its first profit since 2000. It's UAL's first full quarter out of bankruptcy. A top U.S. securities regulator will testify before a Senate panel tomorrow to discuss the hedge fund industry. The hearing aims to assess whether there should be more oversight over the industry. Australian scientists have developed a pill that could stop or slow the onset of Alzheimer's disease. Human trials will begin in September. The latest Lundberg survey of gasoline prices finds that the average price of a gallon of unleaded is now more than $3 a gallon. That's the highest price in 25 years. Light sweet crude settled at $75.05 today. And at the close of Wall Street, the Dow is up 183 points at 11,051. NASDAQ up 41 points at 2062. S&P 500 up 21 points at 1261. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights. They're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Howdy. One question. Can we do something about Sunday, please? I mean, rename it or something. Name it not Saturday or post-Saturday or pre-Monday or anything but Sunday. Ugh. I mean, you understand. Weekends are tough for me to get through. You know, all these, you know, you got your meet the presses and your face the this weeks and all of the Sunday blather shows. And I just sit there and just sort of got to take it. Poor Agnes gets the bulk of my venting over the weekend. I don't know. I may have to go to a 7-day week or something. I think I'd probably have to produce the show on Saturday and Sunday, though, because, you know, Agnes digs her weekend.
I only eat bonbons. I
mean, you lay around and you TiVo your soap operas and eat bonbons. Right, exactly. Not. She's going to hit me with that skillet, and probably with the waffle iron side to it, too, with all of my luck. But there is a boatload of, well, there's always a boatload of stuff. There's no let-up, is there? There's absolutely no let-up. I was thinking we'd start, perhaps, I don't know, maybe there's a theme later tonight. And, you know, I mean, if I mention the name and you don't know it right off the bat, you can run out and find out who this guy was. I was reminded by a couple of things I saw today and over the last couple of days. I was reminded of Colonel John Chivington. Colonel John Chivington and the Sand Creek Massacre. I'll tell you why a little bit later. But there are some stark and painful similarities out there to some stuff from the Old West. Somewhere in these Chiricahua Hills, no white man will ever know where, the Apaches buried Cochise, the greatest of their great chiefs. Now you can find out about that in the new Time Life series, The Old West. Now there's some stories from the Old West. Particularly Colonel John Chivington and the Sand Creek Massacre that seem to have found their way into the time machine and come forward to the present day. But that's not the front end of the program. By no means is that the front end of the program, because here shortly after the break, we're going to be joined by a very special guest, namely Jeff Goodell.
We have a new caller on the line right now.
We do? First time caller on the line?
Georgia from California.
Oh, Georgia from California. Yeah.
Hey, is this Bob?
Yes, it is.
Well, Bob, how are you?
I'm well, Georgia. Yourself?
You need to tell me how your dad is.
Okay. Holding steady.
Well, you know, I lost my mom some time back, so I can empathize a little bit there.
I appreciate that. I think at some point in time, it's almost unavoidable that we go through these things.
Yeah. Well, listen, I will get to the point and let you get on with the program.
No hurry.
You know, on Friday, you talked about stem cell research, and I was listening to that archive. Thank God for Bruce Birch, you know?
Yeah.
That guy is wonderful, and everybody really needs to pull their pennies together and keep him going. That's the commercial portion of my phone call. Now, on the stem cell
did you mean Ben Birch?
I'm Ben Birch. I'm sorry. I said Bruce. Okay. I meant Ben. Bruce has got a good show, though.
Oh, he's got a wonderful show. We are Birch poor on the Head On Radio Network.
Yeah. They both do a wonderful job. But Ben Birch, that's whom I meant.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to say that this is my comment. These religious wackos, because that's what they are, wackos, they run around with their hair on fire, and all the time, every time they want to point that sanctimonious finger, they say, God's will. It's God's will. Everything is God's will. Well, did they ever consider the fact that because they can't conceive in the normal way, God might be telling them no?
Yeah, well, precisely.
And then they go beyond that and say, well, we'll just disregard what God says and implant.
Well, that's a very good point, Georgia. And one of the things that just drives me absolutely around the bend about this is these are the same people who say, you know, Adam and Eve rode dinosaurs.
I'm telling you.
And, you know, evolution is satanic. When the very techniques that are used to create these snowflake babies have their roots in evolutionary science.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, they're hypocrites, and they're also very, very dangerous. I posted an essay to the wonderful folks over at WD40.com, you know, uh-huh. Clyde and Wally and Dookie. I posted them an essay that will go up, I think, in the morning, just some of my thoughts on fundamentalists and fundamentalism and what it really means for the state of the nation. These people are dangerous across the board, and I'm afraid, Georgia, that too many of us don't take them at their fully dangerous face value.
I know that, and they're scary. They're scary people, you know?
Yeah.
They're not just your ordinary garden variety, I'm a Jehovah Witness. You know, it's not that bunch. That's a whole different thing. But really, they're certifiable, some of them.
Well, the thing, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses are kind of willing to wait for whatever it is they're waiting for.
But they are.
You know, and only 144,000 people are going to heaven. And there's more than 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses.
I brought that up one day. I said, you know, there's limited space. Are you sure you're going to make it?
Yeah. But see, they're you pay your money, you take your chances with the Jehovah's Witnesses. But the thing is, these crazy fundamentalists, they're not willing to wait. They think if they can get Israel shipped another big basket of bombs, that maybe that's the final firecracker under Jesus' butt that makes him say, well, boys, let's roll.
That's it. We're rolling home. Yeah, here we come. No, you know what? Roll home by yourself.
Yeah.
I don't want to go with you, okay?
I don't want to be a part of their heaven.
Thank you. You know, but then there was the other thing, just a small thing. You had mentioned that, you had wondered what the Arabian word for bush was on Friday's show.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the Arabian word for bush is, but we do know what the Arabian word for the base is. And isn't that how Bush refers to his elite as his base?
Ooh.
Al-Qaeda?
Al-Qaeda, the base.
That's right. That's his base.
Oh, it just gets uglier and uglier, Georgia.
Hey, you know, this guy, these people, this whole mess, I'm telling you. I shudder. My mom and dad were World War II, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they would have already taken up arms over this. They call us radicals. I've been called a radical before. I'm not a radical. I'm a product of my parents.
Right.
And they would have been pitchforks and torches to the White House by now over there.
Well, precisely. And the thing is, and it's a discussion, you mentioned my dad at the front of the call, it's a discussion my father and I have had. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, the pity of it all is that your generation is just a little too old to take to the streets now.
That's
when
right.
when we need you. We need you almost as badly now as when you were young and fighting fascism.
Exactly. And you know, my generation, we were Vietnam.
Yeah.
We took to the streets for Vietnam, but the lion is long in the tooth on us, too.
Well, but the thing is, Georgia, we need you guys. I
know, and believe me, we're doing what we can. You know, we are the ones that are sitting here behind our computers making sure that we're pounding the keyboards to get the message to our Congress people. We're the ones that flood their email boxes and don't give them any rest.
Well, and, you know, there is no overestimating the value of that. And frankly, it shows a lesson to my generation and generations younger than me. I was over at Democratic Underground, and I read a post by someone in the Alabama forum, because I follow that forum and the West Virginia forum as well. And he's someone we've talked to in the past. I consider him a friend of the program, but he said, you know, these people, and he's talking about his home state of Alabama, he said, they just make me want to give up and hope that the generation that's coming up behind me will pick up the torch.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can't give up.
That's what we're hoping and praying for, basically. It's going to be people of your generation and younger, my grandchildren's generation, that they're going to have to take up the gauntlet, you know. And I don't envy them the job. I don't envy you the job. You and Agnes are doing a wonderful job in what you're doing. You're getting the word out, and that's what it's all about, keeping us current and getting the word out. And that's probably the most important job to have right now, because there's so many people that don't get the word. All they get is very limited access to it. You know, and how many times have you heard people call, like your show or other shows you might be listening to, where somebody calls in and says, oh, my God, it's like a breath of fresh air. It's like a cool drink of water. I never heard this. I didn't know it existed. Okay?
Yep.
So your job.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah, and your job is the most important. Yeah, we don't need other hands-on things and get out there and get people to vote and make sure they get to the polls. Hopefully their vote will be counted. Who knows? Hopefully. But, you know, your job is to get that word out. You know, that's the most important thing. And with people like you and Agnes and Mike and Randy and all of you, Tom Hartman, all of you, you know, we couldn't ask for better. You're all great.
Well, thank you. You've just named me in some mighty tall company, Georgia, and I appreciate it.
Well, let me let you go now.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk to you.
Hey, it's nice to talk to you, too, and I'll drop you a line once in a while.
Okay, you do that. I always enjoy your notes.
Thank you, you too, and love to Agnes, the children, and my best to your father.
Thank you so very much.
Okay.
Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our good friend Georgia in California. Let's see. Agnes, do you want to take a break, or shall we roll? Well, okay, let me set this up. We're going to shift gears here for a minute. I mentioned earlier I've been wanting to get this gentleman on the program for quite some time, and frankly couldn't find his contact information. I owe a great debt of thanks to our dear friend Judy down at Coal River Mountain Watch, because Judy is an angel who makes things happen. I just mentioned in passing in an email, you know, could you help me reach Jeff Goodell? Because Jeff is the author of a marvelous, marvelous book that deserves your attention, called Coal, Big Coal. I'm sorry. I'm all worked up. I'm a fan. Okay, I'm guilty. I'm a fan, but it is called Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. And I read this back when I was in Alabama with my dad. Through the good graces of the Florence Lauderdale Public Library and Uber reference librarian Kyle, and it's a head turner and it's a page turner. So let me welcome to the program Jeff Goodell. Are you with us there, Jeff?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Let me first ask you. Now I know you've written a book in the past regarding the Kew Creek disaster in Pennsylvania. Is that what moved you to the broader scope of coal as a whole?
Well, no, actually it isn't. I mean, that was certainly an important part of putting this book together. But I first got interested in this before that, when I came to West Virginia to write a story for the New York Times Magazine in 2001, at about the time that the Bush administration was releasing its energy plan, and it was clear that they were going to be pushing fossil fuels very hard during the administration. for the New York Times asked me to come down and write about the comeback of coal. And that was the first time I really looked into the industry and to what it means for West Virginia. And I did that piece, but it was, you know, you can only do so much in a magazine piece. And it was clear to me then that it deserved much more thinking and reporting. And so I started the book, and then I got involved with the Cue Creek miners after that, after the book was already started.
Now, of course, Sago occurred in January, and I imagine the book was already going to press by then. Do you, you know, you say, you know, the dirty secret behind America's energy future is coal with us to stay? Or, I mean, you know, I'm in West Virginia. Are we stuck with what we're getting here?
Well, I mean, I think coal is certainly with us to stay for the foreseeable future. I think that, you know, as gas prices and oil prices rise and the, you know, desire to become, you know, energy independent becomes more and more powerful, and that becomes more and more powerful politically, I think more and more people will be turning to coal. I think that... So, you know, I think in the near term, you know, the next 20 or 30 years, it's certainly, you know, going to be with us. After that, you know, who knows? But, you know, so yes, the answer is I think it is going to be with us. And I think the question is are we going to, you know, use coal well and use it in a sustainable way, or are we just going to, you know, use it in an exploitive way that levels the mountains and causes, you know, great problems with air pollution and, with, you know, greenhouse gas emissions for climate change and things. So I think it's a question of, are we going to use it right or are we going to use it poorly in, you know, these coming years?
Do you see it trending in one direction or the other?
Well, I don't see a whole lot of hopeful progress right now. I think that, you know, there's, for example, there's 150 new coal plants either permitted or planned in the United States right now, and all but a handful of them, maybe five or six, use the same old technology, the same old kind of polluting technology that they used, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And I don't see them cracking down on, say, mountaintop removal mining regulations at all. I don't see much happening with mine safety. You know, there's a little bit since the Sago disaster, but nothing really significant. I don't think we're going to see certainly any change in any of this until after the Bush administration leaves. And,
well, that was one of the questions I was coming to, Jeff, because, you know, there were somewhat stricter regulations within the permitting process for mountaintop removal operations during the Clinton administration. We have been, since the advent of George Bush, we've been clarified a lot. And it seems like the more we get clarified, the dirtier things get.
Right. Well, you know, that's true. And hopefully, that clarification will end, or it will change. The dynamic will change, you know, under a less blatantly coal-friendly administration, because it really does come from the top, and it really does, you know, the who is president and who is controlling Congress really does mean an awful lot for these kinds of things. And so I think the only hope of real change, in, especially from the mountaintop removal angle, is, you know, a change in administration and a change in Congress. And, you know, that may come after the 2008 election.
Well, you know, there's a lot of us out there, fingers, toes. If we can cross it, it's crossed for November.
Right.
But now you're touring with the book, and you're getting the word out about the book. You've been all over the United States. Is there... Yeah, we're sort of... I'm isolated, and then I say we. I mean my friends like Judy and Nanette and the Bo and Patty and folks down there at Coal River Mountain Watch. We're kind of isolated here. They get out some. They're trying to spread the word. I'm trying to spread it here. You're certainly doing it with your book. Is there a rising awareness of do folks where you go outside the Appalachians have an understanding of what we mean when we say mountaintop removal?
Well, very, very poorly. I mean, it's unfortunately very easy to just sort of look away and to close your eyes to that and to, you know, basically deny it. And it's very hard. I mean, I feel that very powerfully when I'm going around to, around the United States. And, you know, unless people have actually visited the place and unless they can really see for themselves what's going on, it's very, very hard to communicate you know, the urgency and the destruction that's happening in West Virginia. And with the book, one of the things I tried to do was, you know, paint a larger picture of the whole cost of our dependency on coal. To talk about everything from mercury emissions and, you know, the mercury warnings on fish consumptions in almost every state in America, to, you know, the air pollution deaths, to global warming issues, mine safety issues, and really give a bigger, comprehensive look at our dependency on coal and what it really costs us.
And what is it, 24,000 people a year? I mean, we hear a lot about, oh, secondhand smoke from cigarettes and things like that. 24,000 people a year die as a direct result of air pollution and coal-fired emissions. Did I read that right?
You certainly did, and it's the only clarification I would say is the way this statistic comes from the American Lung Association, and it's based on rock-solid science from Harvard and many years of study. The only clarification I would say is that it's 24,000 premature deaths. So, you know, a lot of these deaths are people who have heart disease, people who have diabetes, people who have certain kinds of conditions that are exacerbated or made much worse by living in places.
And that's before you even get around to counting, occupational pneumoconiosis, black lung, that kind of thing, right?
Right. And it's before you get around to talking about mercury and toxic mercury in developing children. You know, it's before you talk about mine safety, you know, or, you know, the biggest issue of all, you know, global warming. So, you know, when you start to add these up, the cost of our dependency on coal are truly staggering.
Well, you just said the magic word, global warming, or words. Jeff, it drives me absolutely batty because we on the left, we're having very earnest discussions about where the world is, where the world is headed, what's going on vis-a-vis climate change, warming, and yet on the loony right, all we're getting is, well, that's only a theory.
Right.
Is there books like yours? Do you think it stands a chance of getting through some of this literally smokescreen?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I actually, this may sound strange, but I actually do feel like, and not my book particularly. I mean, I'm just one drop in a much larger ocean. But you know, I do feel like there's, when it comes to global warming, that there is real change and real progress, and I mean, even in the 4 years I worked on this book, when I first started out, there was still a real solid kind of contingent of scientists who were really skeptical and you know, who were respected scientists, not the sort of lunatic fringe that is paid by Peabody Energy and, you know, ExxonMobil and stuff, not the people who are blatantly in the pockets of the industry, but, you know, respected scientists who still had debate and hesitations about this. And even in the 4 years I worked on this book, that's pretty much ended. And the science debate is really kind of even over, even among skeptics. And now this, you know, it's moved on to this, well, what do we do about it issue, which is, you know, complicated and difficult in its own way. But, you know, at least there's some progress. And I really do think that, I mean, things like Hurricane Katrina, opened people's eyes a little bit to the possible consequences of, you know, a climate gone awry and what that could mean. I think it's slowly, you know, seeping in, and, you know, these heat waves we're having, and not that any one of them is directly attributable to global warming, but you know, the amounting evidence of it all, I think, is becoming apparent to pretty much everybody.
Well, you mentioned this blistering heat wave that has traversed the country recently. I'm seeing news reports out of California today that the state government there is warning of the possibility of rolling blackouts or rolling brownouts. What frightens me is that when we see things like this, Jeff, it's gonna be an opportunity for the coal industry to turn around and see, we need more coal-fired power plants. This wouldn't be happening to California if you just let us build some more old coal-fired power plants.
That's precisely right. It's so true. I was actually thinking about that this afternoon when I was listening to the same reports as you, and it's exactly the kind of argument that they use all the time. They're using it in Texas right now with TXU, has proposed 11 new big coal plants. They're using it in Denver, where I was just last week. to build some new coal plants, you know, and you know, someone has to call them on this, and people are beginning to call them on this, and you know, but it's true that that is exactly the kind of rhetoric that they use, and you know, it's wrong and it's shameless, but nevertheless, you know, they get away with it a lot of the time, and you know, America's energy problems, unfortunately, are really profound and complex, and this is an example of why they're so sort of screwed up. You know, is that instead of talking about efficiency or, you know, cutting down demand for power or figuring out ways to use less energy, all the talk is simply about, well, we got to build more big coal plants. And, you know,
well, with those big coal plants, Jeff, let me back you up for just a second, because you mentioned when in talking about the power plants, that are, the coal-fired power plants that are being built, you said, and it's the same old technology that they've been using for umpteen years.
Right.
Now, when the whole Clean Air Act, another clarification, clear skies, you know, it's laugh or cry, you know, mm-hmm. your choice. When they were busy clarifying the Clean Air Act, they came up with this credit trade-out thing, the Bush EPA did, where cleaner power plants would swap off with dirty power plants, and we'd rob Peter and we'd pay Paul and we'd balance the books that way, which seemed, it seemed like crazy hoodoo to me. Now, if the technology is old technology, where is the room for these credits to be traded?
Well, I think what you're referring to is what's called the Acid Rain program, which started this trading emissions in sulfur dioxide, the main pollutant that causes smog and acid rain. And
well, they did it with mercury, too, in the last year or so,
right,
I do believe.
They're trying to do it with mercury, and although they're embroiled in a lot of lawsuits on that, they are trying to do it with that. And they're eventually going to do it with carbon also. I think trading is, you know, this idea of trading is actually, you know, a sort of good way of reducing overall emissions, and it certainly worked with sulfur dioxide. But the main point is that the reason they're able to do this is that even though the essential technology of the plants, you know, especially basically pounding up rocks and burning them to create steam to spin a generator, hasn't changed in 60 years, you know, they are getting better at putting scrubbers on plants to reduce these particular emissions of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. So they are cleaner in that sense, and that's how they're able to get the reduction that they're talking about for these trading programs.
But they've had to be dragged kicking and screaming all the way, have they not?
They have had to be dragged kicking and screaming all the way, and they've been, not only that, they've spent millions of dollars lobbying against them, and they spend a lot of time talking about how the American economy will collapse if you dare to make us put these scrubbers on the plants. And now, of course, they've put the scrubbers on the plants, and, you know, they're running television commercials talking about how clean coal is now because they've made these improvements in air quality, which in many cases are true, and
yeah.
They have improved the air quality, but they haven't explained to us, you know, that, as you said, they had to be dragged kicking and screaming. And these beautiful commercials of children, you know, breathing clean air don't show any, there's no pictures in the backdrop of the decapitated mountains of West Virginia.
Well, there's
of the greenhouse gases going up into the atmosphere to destabilize the climate.
Well, the other side of the coin, being in Appalachia, I think about our mountains here. I've seen them; it's nightmarish. But we do somewhat of a disservice, do we not, by focusing only on Appalachia? What's happening? What is it? The Powder River Basin?
Right.
In the American West is being utterly destroyed, they don't have mountains to level. They just gouge out humongous pits in the earth.
Right.
And that is equally as devastating to that ecosystem as what's going on here, is it not?
It is from an ecosystem point of view, but the difference is, there's a couple of differences. Is one is that, first of all, it's not as fragile an ecosystem. One of the real problems, as you know, with mountaintop removal in Appalachia is what it's doing to the water supply system, the damming up of all these streams, the acid mine drainage, the heavy metals from the coal impoundment ponds getting into aquifers, making people sick. It's you know, besides the obvious problems of mountaintop removal, the water supply issues is really, you know, the, I think, most serious issue associated with all of this mountaintop removal mining. And essentially in Wyoming, there is no water there, so there is no issue with that. And the other thing is, there's no one living there. I mean, you know, you're not having communities being destroyed, you know. having floods wiping out people, all of this kind of stuff. So, you know, in a certain from a certain point of view, you know, it is better what's going on there. But unfortunately, you know, you can't run America simply on Wyoming coal. And supporting coal means, you know, supporting mountaintop removal mining and supporting the sort of disemboweling of Illinois and a lot of other stuff that goes with it.
You mentioned the Friends of, well, the, what is it, askaboutcoal.org or whatever the organization is that produces the commercials that we see on CNN with the cute little girl and the
right.
Pristine white curtains that don't have any coal dust blowing right. in the windows. There's a that little girl they've got, she tells, you know, Mama should have told her about telling a fib because she doesn't, she repeats this, we've got 200, we've got 300, you know, it depends on who you read. You know, we've got 500 years left of coal in the ground. We've got more coal than Saudi Arabia has oil. But there's a little, it's a little less than honest, isn't it, Jeff? Because it all of that is based on old numbers, and it presupposes a steady state rate, when I think your research tends to indicate that our coal consumption is rising almost exponentially.
Well, it is, and you know, it is. So it is based on old numbers. They haven't really done a real thorough study of coal reserves in America for 70 years or so, and they don't want to, because the coal industry would rather just go around and tout these vague numbers and rather than have any kind of real accounting. But the real dangerous thing about this myth they perpetuate about having 250 years of coal or something is that they make it sound like it's in one big shiny pile somewhere in the middle of the country, and everybody just has to back their truck up and get their shovels out and have as much coal as they want. But in fact, as West Virginia is the prime example of, we've been mining coal in America for 140 years or so now, and all the best coal, the easiest to get coal, is gone. And the coal that's left is increasingly deeply buried, increasingly complex to go after, and increasingly destructive. And that's why we have these enormous mountaintop removal mines happening, because, you know, they need to blow up these mountains in order to get to this coal, because it's the only way to do it now, because it's too dangerous and difficult to get any other way. And so, you know, the problem is that this kind of mining is just going to get more destructive and more dangerous as time goes on.
Well, there's something else that's bothersome in all this. A lot of us have read a good bit about peak oil, and you mentioned, you know, all the coal that we can get at easily is gone. Shouldn't we also be talking about coal in similar terms? Because that sounds a lot like the peak oil discussion.
It is a little bit like the peak oil discussion, except in the case of oil, oil is nowhere near as environmentally destructive to go after. You know, there's ways of drilling for oil and stuff that are not as disruptive as it used to be. And in the case of oil, it really is a question of, you know, the reserves not being there. In the case of coal, you know, depending on how you count it, you know, the coal is there. It's just unfortunately it's buried under cities and towns, and you can't just run a slender drill hole down in, you know, beneath the town of Beckley or something and get it out. You've got to, you know, move the town. And so it's a fundamentally different kind of operation that's required to get coal out. And so, you know, even if the actual physical reserves are there, the destructiveness and sacrifices that it'll take to get out of the ground are wholly different than with oil.
Well, where then, given the difficulty in getting at it, where then do the coal companies go? I mean, you said earlier that you don't see any real relief in sight from things like mountaintop removal. It's gonna get progressively more expensive. But in your discussion of the true cost of coal, how can we possibly continue to do what we're doing and get away with it?
Well, I think what you're going to see happen is that you're going to see more mining moving to other regions of the country. Illinois, for example, still has, you know, a lot of coal that's very high sulfur that, you know, didn't work because of clean air restrictions on sulfur dioxide emissions. But, you know, if they ever get around to burning coal gasification plants, you know, they will use that Illinois coal. Wyoming coal, you know, there's still a lot of coal left in Wyoming. I mean, I think that what it means is that it's a real, you know, end game for Central Appalachia. I mean, that's the place where the sort of end is going to come first, and where the destructiveness is really going to be felt. And in some of these other places where getting the coal out of the ground is less problematic, you know, you're going to see some of the production or a lot of the production shift to those regions.
Well, you know, you mentioned coal gasification. I guess it was Brian Schweitzer, governor of Montana, who first came out with his declarations on it. And shortly thereafter, our governor, Joe Manchin, started hopping up and down saying, boy, we're going to make us some coal gasoline here in West Virginia, and times are going to be good. Is the coal gasification thing exactly what it's being touted to be?
Well, let me just clarify one thing. There's coal gasification is... it can be referred to. It can refer to two things, and what you're talking about, what Governor Schweitzer in Montana is talking about, and the governor and Governor Manchin in West Virginia is talking about, is coal to liquids.
Yeah, all kinds. I'm sorry, I should have said coal liquefaction.
Right. It uses a kind of similar technology, but not exactly the same thing. But you know, this coal to liquid stuff is you know, just a patently awful idea in every way. It's expensive. It's terribly. It can be done. The Nazis did it during World War II. They're the ones who kind of pioneered it.
Oh, good. We're using Nazi technology. We've got laws about not doing that in medicine.
Well, you know, when times get tough, you know. So it's doable technology, but it's, you know, if you're going to replace Middle Eastern oil, it's incredibly expensive and destructive way to do it. And you know, it's a big step backward for global warming, because the emissions from these coal-to-liquids refineries are about twice the size of an oil refinery. And if you sequester or bury the carbon dioxide underground, you know, that can help alleviate that, but that increases the cost quite a bit. And even under the most optimistic scenario, there was a report done by the National Coal Council, this quasi-advisory board to the Department of Energy that's run by the coal industry. You know, they, you know, even under their most optimistic scenario, if you spend billions and billions of dollars building, you know, a number of these coal to liquids plants around the country, you're still only going to displace, say, 10% of the oil from the Middle East. So, you know, even under this ideal situation, it's only a minor help. And what's really happening is that because oil prices are really high, these coal companies figure they can make a buck in this new market by refining these liquids and refining it into a liquid, and
maybe getting a tax break along the way,
right,
perhaps
huge subsidies. And so,
because
the coal industry has been looking for new markets for a long, long time, and here it is opening up to them, and you know, they're trying to go after it.
Because we had tax subsidies that wound up having coal producers get huge kickbacks for what, spraying diesel fuel on coal at some point.
Right, the old thin fuel subsidies that came out in the 70s that, you know, were supposed to encourage sort of alternative energy research and ended up subsidizing to the tune of billions of dollars these coal companies that spray diesel or pine tar or some other things on them and get huge tax breaks of up to $25 a ton of the coal, almost the price of the coal itself.
I'm in the wrong business.
Yes, absolutely. And so you had all kinds of people like Marriott Hotels and other corporations getting into this business because it was such a blatant, you know, but tax bonanza that they could make hundreds of millions of dollars off of these, you know, absurd loopholes.
You'll forgive me, please, if I say it just makes me want to scream. Well, you know, you said that Appalachia, my state, West Virginia, we're going to pay the price. I suppose we should round this discussion out by asking, what happens when it's gone? What happens to my state when it's gone, Jeff?
Well, that is the big question, and you know, and what will your state look like when it's gone? I mean, you know, I love West Virginia and spent a lot of time there, and I think it's one of the most beautiful states in the country, and the people there are the toughest, the strongest, the most courageous of anyone I've ever met, and you know, there's just no, you know, you can argue with the time frame, but you know, coal is already in its end game in West Virginia, and anyone who pretends otherwise, you know, is not talking honestly about the industry. So, you know, even if coal persists in America, it's still, you know, going to be over in West Virginia relatively soon. And you know, what will it look like? Where does it go? Where does, I mean, the coal industry doesn't care about that. I mean, they never have cared about that. They're all about getting the coal out of the ground, making their millions, and running. I mean, look at someone like Don Blankenship, you know, paid over $30 million last year to the CEO of Massey Energy, the biggest coal company in West Virginia. And, you know, he's taking his money, and he will be fine. You know, Don Blankenship will have his, you know, his nice nest egg wherever he is, and he won't worry too much about what, you know, whether the people in West Virginia have any water left to drink, and if it's poisoned and full of chemicals and heavy metals and things, and if the, you know, the mountains are you know, decapitated and the streams are ruined. And, you know, I don't think, you know, this is a political question. It's about political leadership and about seeing beyond this sort of, you know, the immediate picture and thinking about where West Virginia will go. And there's certainly lots of bright spots, you know, and in some of the northern panhandle parts of the state, you're seeing a lot of new kinds of industries moving in, biometrics industries and things like that, tourism industry.
Well, I live in the middle of Whitewater country, Jeff.
Yeah, so you know.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But the thing is, our tourism industry is going to die a quick death if mountaintop removal expands even a tiny fraction more.
Well, it will, and it is. And you know, it's terribly sad. And just, you know, other than, you know, some kind of political shift in power or something, I don't know how you stop that. You know.
Well, you mentioned politics, and I promise we'll wrap this up, but I'm just loving this conversation, Jeff. Our political leadership right now and for the last 100 years in this state has been indebted to, in the service of, in the pay of, in many instances, the coal industry.
Right.
Where does that grassroots movement comes from that breaks their addiction? I think our political leaders are the ones that need the intervention.
Right. Well, that's, you know, that's one of the fascinating things about my working on this book was, you know, I initially thought it was a, you know, this question of energy and where energy comes from and how we inspire change. I thought it was all about, you know, technology, you know, we need a technology breakthrough, or we needed some kind of, you know, better wind turbines or solar panels or nuclear plants or whatever it happens to be. But it really is a political question. It's all about politics and about how you value your land and your lives and your air you breathe and things. And, you know, I think that, you know, the real hope for West Virginia is in a broad coalition of people working together, not just from the mountaintop removal point of view, that being a major part of it, but also with, you know, global warming people concerned about, you know, mercury emissions, people concerned about air pollution, you know, linking this all together and making the case for why coal is a bad choice for the future. And it's terribly complicated because there's a lot of money and a lot of financial inertia and a lot of political inertia behind this industry, especially in West Virginia.
Well, it amazes me, Jeff, because you mentioned people working together. That coalition building is going on here. But even as we speak, there are a group of what I call fake environmentalists in Greenbrier County who are screaming at the very prospect that a wind farm would go up on a ridgeline that you actually have to drive to see.
I know. That is so, you know, maddening and so hypocritical and so much this sort of middle-class luxury, you know, of hypocrisy on this. I mean, I agree with people like Judy Bonds on this. I mean, I just think that, you know, anyone who's ever been to Boone County or Logan County or McDowell County and seen what's going on there, that anyone who's conscience, you know, worrying about the sort of, you know, disturbance of their view, supposedly, because of these turbines, which I happen to think are quite beautiful.
That, me as well.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the height of moral hypocrisy.
Well, I thank you so much. There's a great deal of scientific learning to be had in your book, but Jeff, I particularly appreciate the fact that you know you're not necessarily from around here, as we say, but you're out there and you're spreading the word, and we thank you for it. We thank you so very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And you know, it's work like yours that is going to change this. And you're doing great work, and I'm happy to be on the show.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Jeff. I hope we'll get to hear from you again sometime.
Okay, Bob. Thanks.
Take care. Bye now. A new friend of the program, Jeff Goodell. Big coal. The dirty secret behind America's energy future. To say that it is packed with information is not even to approach what is in the book. But again, you know, I think Mr. Goodell, Jeff, he's a buddy now, we'll call him Jeff. I think, as he noted, he started out thinking that book was going to go one place, and it went somewhere entirely different. And I'm guessing some of that had to do with the fact that it wasn't just a matter of doing library research or, you know, oh, look at the Department of Energy statistics, and, you know, the Coal Association says we got 300 years of coal in the ground. Instead, he came here. And he met a lot of the people that I consider to be near and dear friends. And he saw the real-time, real-world impact that this craven determination... Because, you know, the Appalachians have sacrificed literally to build this nation. The steel industry in Pittsburgh and Birmingham and Weirton and Bethlehem grew on the backs of miners toiling bent double in the shafts and the drifts of Appalachia. No one can look at my state, my region, and say that we have not given our fair share to build the American dream. And what I think Jeff found out is that while we have given that, a lot of America has taken us for granted. And the best that we can hope for is a wily sheriff in an Appalachian hilltop town with a cute little boy, or a gregarious, wily old mountain man with an aging mother-in-law who drinks moonshine. That's what we get. Yeah, look at that. Yeah. Oh, boy, I tell you what, them hillbillies sure is wily. Eat me. But the fact is, Jeff's right. There is a day coming when there will be no more coal to get. And West Virginia is in its end game. So is Southwest Virginia. So is East Tennessee. So is Eastern Kentucky. I don't know. I'm wondering maybe if we need to get hold of the genetic modifiers out there and see if we can't come up with genetically modified dadgum tumbleweed that we can grow here so it can blow through Beckley and blow through Charleston and blow through Huntington and blow through Bluefield when it's all gone, and Don Blankenship and Massey and Peabody and Arch and International Coal Group pack it all up and leave and say, dang, it was fun. You know, when you in the rest of this nation, when you hear ghost town, for the most part, you get the whole... And the tumbleweeds and the old saloon with the swinging racket, rickety doors hanging from one hinge, and dust, and it's out on the west, and it sits in the middle of a barren plain. And look, there used to be a town there, but it's a ghost town now. Well, you know what? Ghost towns don't just happen out on the prairie. They happen here. And what our political leaders are engaged in now is the active increase in the likelihood that the day of the ghost town comes quicker rather than later. And frankly, that's not fair to my kids. It's not fair to the kids they go to school with. It's not fair, frankly. It is not fair to the guy who works for Massey.
Well, you got job security, boy, because you won't bring in that stinking union. We don't have to worry about packing up and going away. As long as you don't bring that union in, we can keep on paying you them good wages and give you them good benefits and throw you a little picnic down on the river every now and then. Maybe bring Hank Williams Jr. in to play you a song. And we're going to give you, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give you a retirement plan, and it's going to be full of Massey stock. And it's growing. Newsflash, Massey stock dropped by 5% this past quarter. Massey workers, that was 5% of your pension, sunshine. How you feeling about your buddy Don now that he's mismanaging the company so doggone good? What are you going to do, Massey worker? What are you going to do when they pack up and leave? Oh, well, we told you about that job security, but, well, coal done played out. It's time to move on. You want to go where we're going? We're going 500 miles away. I think we're going to go mine coal in China. How you feel about chopsticks, boy? And we've got political leaders who still say, oh, clean coal technology. What we're going to need, fellas, is some no-coal technology. Right? Oh, see that, Bob? He don't love West Virginia. You can tell it because he's not a fiend of coal. I mean, friend. Look it, we done bought you a brand new football game twixt Marshall and WVU. Ain't nothing going to make you happy, boy? I sure do appreciate Jeff Goodell being on the program. I think we could use about 100,000 Jeff Goodells. Maybe then America might stop asking West Virginia to bleed for it. Sorry, folks, I'm not gooning on anybody from anywhere else. But man, we see the blood. Y'all don't. Sorry. So that's the first hour. When we come back, of course, your phone calls are more than welcome. 877, the number 4, head on, 877-443-2366. Email comes in to bob@headonradio.com. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Quality News Network. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice made an unexpected stop in Beirut today on her way to Israel. She met with Lebanon's prime minister and thanked him for his courage. But she also told him that Hezbollah must withdraw from southern Lebanon before a ceasefire can be called. But a Lebanese official said a ceasefire in the 13-day-old conflict must come before any other actions take place. At the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan has called for a meeting in Rome on Wednesday. The goal of the meeting would be to negotiate a ceasefire, deploy an international force, and negotiate the release of the two Israeli soldiers Hezbollah is holding hostage. On the Israel-Lebanon border, fierce fighting continued today with 8 civilian deaths in southern Lebanon. Israeli forces captured 2 Hezbollah guerrillas, and Hezbollah fired 90 rockets into Israel. 2 Israeli soldiers were killed in fighting, and 2 others were killed when their helicopters accidentally crashed on the Israeli side. In northern Gaza City today, Israeli strikes killed up to 6 Palestinians. The Israeli army says that came after the Palestinians fired 6 rockets into Israel, causing no casualties. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh is asking the U.S. to pressure Israel into stopping its attacks. In Iraq today, 2 U.S. soldiers were killed as they fought death squads. They're believed to be linked with armed groups of Sunnis or Shiites. Officials say the city morgue today received 19 bodies, some of them showing signs of torture. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will travel to Washington, D.C. tomorrow to meet with President Bush. They're expected to discuss adding more U.S. and Iraqi troops to help stop the rising violence. In Baghdad, Saddam Hussein's trial resumed today without him. He's in the hospital and being fed through a tube after a more than 2-week hunger strike. He stopped eating to protest the killing of 3 of his defense lawyers. In Mumbai, India, officials have arrested a 4th suspect in connection with this month's train bombings. A judge has ordered he be held in police custody until early August. In California, a heat wave has forced the state into a power emergency with the potential of more blackouts. At least 4 deaths are being blamed on the heat. And in the North Pacific Ocean, members of the U.S. Coast Guard and Air Force are trying to help a container ship which is taking on water. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
Global trade talks in Geneva fell apart today after leading countries failed to agree on opening up farm and manufactured goods trade. A group of investors has announced plans to purchase HCA Incorporated, the largest for-profit hospital chain in the U.S. The group will assume nearly $12 billion in debt in the $21 billion deal. And Advanced Micro Devices is buying ATI Technologies in a more than $5 billion deal. The parent company of United Airlines is expected to post its first profit since 2000. It's UAL's first full quarter out of bankruptcy. Australian mental health scientists have developed a pill that could stop or slow the onset of Alzheimer's disease. Human trials will begin in September. Walgreens has announced plans to open more health clinics in its drugstores across the country. The clinics will offer vaccines and diagnosis and treatment of some medical conditions. AOL is expected to offer more of its services for free, including email accounts. The Time Warner Board will review AOL's proposals with the goal of increasing advertising. Panasonic will sell a flat-screen 103-inch plasma television in the U.S. by the holiday season. It's the size of a queen-size bed and will sell for $70,000. Light Sweet Crude settled at $75.05 today, and at the close of Wall Street, the Dow was up 183 points, NASDAQ up 41, S&P 500 up 21. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, we're back. 5 minutes after the hour. Calculating the internet delay, it's probably 6 and a half past by the time you heard me say 5 after, so deal with it. I'm Bob. This is Head On. It's Monday night, and I'm so excited to be back. What a great conversation. At least I enjoyed it with Jeff Goodell. Listen, if you want to buy the book, would you do us a favor, please? Would you go through the link at whiterosesociety.org and buy your book there? It does help Ben keep the streams going when you do that. I think, 2.5 cents a book or something. I don't know. No, seriously, there's an affiliate program, and part of the proceeds do go to support streaming of the horn. Just like next time you need a pair of blue jeans or T-shirt or something, the right thing to do is to click on the No Sweat banner at headonradionetwork.com and go there. Great union-made moral clothing. So, you know, please, on both accounts, please. Man, I miss Hunter Thompson. Man, I miss him. Oh, the hogs are in the tunnel. Did you hear the report about Saddam Hussein? Went on a hunger strike two weeks ago, and now is, quote-unquote, accepting a feeding tube? You know what that means, right? I mean, nurse.
Yes.
Nurse, could you open your microphone, please? It's a moment with Nurse Agnes.
Yes, doctor.
I'm not a doctor, and I don't even play one on the radio. Saddam Hussein has accepted a feeding tube. Care to define that for the non-medically oriented, non-nurse trained, never...
You mean they shoved a feeding tube down him, having him restrained?
Well, up his nose and down him, right?
Yes, sedated, yes. Well, it could be a feeding tube placed that way, or they could have implanted a J-tube into his stomach. I mean, there's no telling. They didn't specify.
Well, you know, I can't help it. I don't trust it.
Yes, you do run a feeding tube through the nasal canal down into the tummy. But, you know, if it becomes displaced, you can get
kind of comes
pneumonia.
Out the eustachian tube, runs down into the gullet. You know.
Yeah, and you can get pneumonia and die from a displaced tube being fed.
Well, you know, I'm really not making light of the situation. But I remember the last time I heard about... someone accepting, because that's the word, and, you know, I trust our friends at Quality News Network, someone accepting a feeding tube. The last time I heard about that, Agnes, was a prisoner on a hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, accepting a feeding tube. You know what they did to help him accept the feeding tube, dear?
Rammed it down?
Oh, well, no, but before you get to the ramming part...
Sedated him.
Strapped him to a chair and crammed it up his nose.
Well, that's usually, you know, that's
because we wanted to keep him from starving to death and committing suicide so as we could execute him later.
Well, usually if someone's on a hunger strike, they're not going to accept a feeding tube.
Unless they're in such a weakened state that they really have no choice.
True. And very sedated. It's not a pleasant experience.
Our friend Gail just noted he bets they're force-feeding Saddam pork chops.
Okay.
Oh, God, I wouldn't put it past him. But I remember when Saddam was caught. What was that, December of 2003? And I said shortly thereafter, might even still be in the archive somewhere. No, the archives didn't start then. I said shortly thereafter that Saddam would never finish out a trial.
Well, I have a question. How many body doubles did Saddam have?
Oh, bunches. I mean, they had whole Saddam body double parties.
So, are they sure that it's Saddam? I mean, it seems...
Oh, it's Saddam. It's Saddam. No one could be that evil and not be Saddam.
Well, it seems a little coincidental that he just managed to be in that hole for them to find. I mean, they haven't found the guy with the dialysis machine walking around.
Oh, you mean
yet.
The 6'6" Arab?
Yeah, on the cell phone.
Have you seen Osama bin Laden? You mean the 6'6" Arab, one kidney, walks with a limp, filthy rich, dirty clothes, AK-47? Yeah, that guy. Haven't seen him.
No. So they find Saddam conveniently placed in a hole. Right. Okay.
No, but I did. I guess early in the beginnings of this program, I said, well, you know, Saddam will either have a heart attack, a stroke, or be shot trying to escape. We have not yet decided which one. I'm telling you, Mr. Finch, Bob Ewell fell on his knife 17 times. I hate to make light of this kind of thing. I wouldn't pee on Saddam Hussein if his guts were on fire, okay? But this is just getting clownish. This is getting ludicrous. It's getting silly. The whole thing in Iraq, let's see, stack of stories, here they are. Did you catch this on CNN? Did you catch it on NBC or anywhere else? I caught it on The Independent from the UK via our very good friends at truthout.org. Straight off the press. See, I got ink stains on my thumbs. Oh, leaving fingerprints.
Don't do that.
The Iraqi Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, meets Tony Blair in London today. As violence in Iraq reaches a new crescendo, and senior Iraqi officials say the breakup of the country... See, this is the... They buried the lead. Even the Independent buried the lead. And senior Iraqi officials say the breakup of the country is inevitable. Now, see, I'm the editor. I got that story. I'm thinking, no, we're going to lead with senior Iraqi officials say breakup of Iraq is inevitable. That, to me, is news. A senior government official was quoted as saying, quote, Iraq as a political project is finished. The parties have moved to Plan B. You know, actually, I think they're on Plan A because we never had a plan. I mean, we had a plan. Greg Palast a week ago tonight told us about the plan, or almost a week ago, told us about the plan. There were two plans. There was a State Department plan, and there was a Pentagon plan. And they fought like a certain 9-year-old girl and 10-year-old boy I know fight. Just ugly, nasty fighting. Lots of crying. And neither one of them ever came to fruition.
Bob's a tree, too.
So, you know, no, I don't think this is Plan B. There is serious talk of Baghdad being divided into Shia East and Sunni West. The government is all in the green zone like the previous one, and they have left the streets to the terrorists, said Mahmoud Othman, a veteran Iraqi politician. He said the situation would be made worse by the war in Lebanon because it would intensify the struggle between Iran and the U.S. being staged in Iraq. The Iraqi crisis would now receive much reduced international attention. Well, Mr. Othman, buddy... That's what was supposed to happen, okay? That's how it was supposed to work. Maliki's trip to Washington is all part of the U.S. domestic agenda to put a good face on things for November, a European diplomat in Baghdad was quoted as saying. Now, this is an open question, and I ask it not facetiously, but desperately seriously. At what point do the neocon war criminals and murderers come to us, their little hats in their hands, and say, We're sorry. You were right. And we were wrong. The answer, as just enunciated by Agnes with her microphone off, is, say it loud and say it proud, dear.
Never.
Thank you, Agnes. Quoth the neocon,
nevermore.
Look, it's 15 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break and come back. That's not all. No, no, no. That's not all there is. Not by a long shot. It was a happy day in the world today. Oh, Lord God, Billy Bob, it was just cheerful. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network.
Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
You know, the president came out and talked about the Iraq War and how he had a strategy to win the peace. I have some exclusive audio. This is actually him preparing for the speech in front of the mirror. This is him laying out the strategy for Iraq.
That was the most coherent thing I've heard him say in ages, man.
You know, if he really spoke that way, it would be so much better for us all. Because at least then we would know that he's an incoherent bastard. We could have him locked up.
And that's just a taste of what Bruce and I got up to last weekend. Come and join us next weekend, Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. To get the stream details, go to fourthestateradio.com. That's fourthestateradio.com.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
We often hear claims Muslims don't condemn terrorism.
And that Islam condones violence.
As Muslims, we want to state clearly
that those who commit acts of terror in the name of Islam are betraying the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad.
We reject anyone of any faith who commits such brutal acts.
And will not allow our faith to be hijacked by criminals.
Islam is not about hatred and violence. It's about peace and justice.
I was born on this mountain. This is where I was raised. And I went north to
what the factories. I knew I'd come back someday. When I did, things were different. This land was run by massive gold. Taking tops off of the mountains, burying the streams below. And it's cold, dust-covered houses, run-down towns play a mournful tune. The land is gone, the once lived on, underneath the blackened moon.
20 minutes after the hour, for those of you who have not yet been reached with the new high technology known as clock. Ugly, ugly habit among broadcast people. No, you got to do the time check. I mean, what if they're in a hurry? What if they don't know what time it is? don't laugh at your own jokes, Bob. Let's go to the phones. I'm proud not to make Luke wait until a half an hour this time through. Hey, Luke, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Well, I don't know. My son dials in. He gets good time. You know how it goes.
It's right twice a day.
Hey, even that blinking 12 o'clock is right on the VCR every once in a while. It's just like, say, time just seems to slow down for that. You know how it is.
Well, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of stuff that that is associated with the broadcast gig. I mean, there are still radio stations around here, Luke, that sell sponsorships of the weather. This weather brought to you by, you know, Smithfield's Funeral Home.
If they didn't sponsor it, it wouldn't be here today. You know that, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
I was sitting here watching Countdown, and they were sitting here showing some video that I don't know who it came from, but that was had an insurgent video down there. And it's like these guys, all they have to set up is like a 3-point stand, set the missile down, fire it. It's like, and for this, Israel is blowing towns up. It's like.
Yeah, I know.
There is no infrastructure for that.
It is. No, there's not. Luke, frankly, it's just a slightly higher technology than that of a bottle rocket.
Well, it's one of those things.
Got me like a pop can. Got me some bottle rockets. You know.
I figure they should search everybody, see if you can find a really big rubber band on some of them. You know how it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting to that point. But how did you enjoy the links to the Media Matters stuff?
Oh, isn't that just amazing?
Well, the one that got me first of all was the Cavuto thing. It's like, here are my Middle East experts.
Yeah, when you're who was it? It was Ann Coulter and Bo Deedle, yeah. How can I forget Bo Deedle? When that's the bottom of the barrel you're scraping for a Middle East expert, I'm expecting a phone call, Luke.
Uh-oh.
I mean, I got as much street cred on the Middle East as Ann Coulter and Bo Deedle, for God's sake.
People, if you've ever listened to Hyman, all you have to do is listen to Bo Deedle for about 3 minutes and realize he should be wearing the white sheet over his head.
Oh yeah, he's just nasty.
Oh, he's just downright racist.
I think finally now that all the, I don't know, tell me what you think, Luke. I think now that all of the demographics are so well known that Rupert Murdoch has more or less just. You know, he's pulled the curtain back, and there the white sheets are. I mean, that's the only thing they could do. I mean, they're Klansmen. They're right-wing, just nasty, racist jerks.
Well, you saw the thing was it this past week with Snow, when he essentially, you know, went after Helen Thomas.
Yeah, thank you for the response from Hezbollah, you old Arab.
I mean, that's the only thing he didn't include in it. You know what I mean?
But that's because Ann Coulter's always out there to fill that part in. Hateful old Arab.
I tell you what, the one I'm waiting on is the. I just saw the thing, the link I sent you. The thing with Oberman.
I don't think I got that yet.
The one with holding up the O'Reilly face thing in front of.
Oh, him. I haven't seen that yet. I didn't have a chance.
It was some thing that he's not on tonight. I think he's doing some kind of. This thing was some kind of, I think like a book fair or something. I don't know what it was. It was some event. And they were having something, and he had the O'Reilly thing like he does for the for their theater thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that probably O'Reilly was supposed to be there. And it was just sort of like, it's like, please, like, I sent you the link that please let there be video of this.
Yeah, steel cage death match.
Oh, please. Steel cage death match, one corner of the Undertaker, and the other corner, Kane. Let's have it out, boys.
Well, you know, O'Reilly loses that one. Well, because, you know, O'Reilly's a coward. I mean, there would never be a blow struck.
Well, it's like Over was, oh, there's one statement there. Over says, the only good part of it is says I have to, he can look, said if he tries, he said if he looks at me, he has to look me dead square in the eye. Said most people he tries to look over said he can't do that to me. Because they were a couple of tall dudes, let's put it that way. It's like, you know, if the two of them and we have them on Letterman, this could be fun, you know.
Well, everything is coming apart for these people now.
Well, you saw, I saw something this evening. They were talking about said that some statement Cheney had given out said, well, we're seeing all this, and this is why you should keep the GOP. And I said, why, a bigger body count? I mean, here you send Condoleezza Rice over there, and essentially she's already said, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to sit back and watch for the next 2 weeks. I mean, it's like, you know, then why the heck are you even going?
Well, you know,
you freaking flyer miles, what?
This, no, it's a failure, Luke. I mean, there's it almost see what it does?
Uh-huh.
It defies description.
Well, it's one of those things. But when they do the, you know, Washington Post does their questions. You know what I mean? Their things during the day. You know, they have people on answer over their blog things. I sometimes want to really write Dana Priest when she does hers. She does like one a week.
Mm-hmm.
Just ask her, has Condoleezza Rice ever had a success as either the NSA, head of the NSA, or as our Secretary of State? I really would like to see a list of what she considers her successes.
Well, have you noticed her game face?
Oh.
I mean, I'm not trying to be crude or anything. Oh, Agnes is doing the Condi game face, and it's just bad.
Uh-oh. She's giving you the game face.
Yeah, one of these days when we get all fancied up, we'll have a webcam.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw the picture today. I just, you know, went over to the, what is it, the, oh, I think my browser opens the MSN homepage.
Oh, okay.
But there was this, if you went to the story about, the so-called negotiations or peace offer or whatever, it was a story out of the Associated Press with a photo of Condi looking so serious across the table at Fuad Sanora
across the table and shook hands. Oh.
Yeah, but the comment that I got when she, I think it was when she landed in Beirut today, Luke, she said, these are the birth pangs of a new Mideast. And as is so often the case, Luke, I simply wanted to scream.
Yeah, we couldn't scream that loud. We really couldn't. It's like, you know, you'd have to have a voice like Pavarotti to scream as loud as we'd really like.
The birth pangs of a new Mideast? What kind of new Mideast? I mean, this is the kind of this is the kind of millenniumism that you get. You know, it's going to be the new Jerusalem.
I heard somebody talking earlier today. They were talking about the fact that, you know, they're trying to say, well, we want to get in NATO or the UN and all this. I said, oh yeah, that's good. Let's see, one of the groups you'll put in. Let's see, between the Lebanese and the Syrians on one side, the Israelis on the other side. We're going to drop the Turks and the Greeks in between them. Oh, this is going to be fun.
Well, you know, they've had up until recently, although it looks like they may be backing out because they're just not willing to die for it, the Indians and the Ghanans.
Oh, God.
And, you know, they've done a creditable job.
Some of them want to get out of where they are, is the problem.
Right. You know, the Ghanians... I think they lost a guy in the last few days. Everybody made it to the bunker but him. I mean, they've got bunkers because they know that Israel is going to bomb the snot out of them.
It's one of the ones you're just waiting to see who makes the worst stupid move first.
Well, that would be us.
Well, yeah, of course that. But
you know, when they fired up the engines and Condi got on the plane, that qualified.
It's like, I hope George gave her her medal before she left. You know, just. Put things in perspective.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the way they gave what? Gary Bremer and, yeah.
Oh. It's like he should have already given her one and just said, here, hide this till you get over there and then take it out.
Yeah, just present it to yourself whenever you feel like it.
Yeah. But, it, you know, it's just one of those things. I'm just waiting to see the Israelis, who apparently now are even shooting at ambulances.
Yeah.
I'm just waiting to see. I have a feeling one of them will eventually drift over Syria and start firing. You know what I mean? Because right there where that three-way border is there between Israel, Syria,
oh,
and Lebanon.
Oh, first bullet comes from Syria and it's over.
It's over.
It's either over or it's begun, depending on which kind of terminology you want to use.
The thing is, the minute either one of them starts it, you know, the prime minister over there, I guess, is going to have to say the Lebanese army go. You know,
well, the Lebanese army's already said that if Israel invades, they're gonna get in behind Hezbollah.
Yeah.
What do you do if you're a nation and you're a sovereign state and another sovereign state invades you? What do you do but fight them?
It's like, you know, this is our place. We get to have our fun here. You go over there. You got your own country. Go have fun. You know, you want to shoot some people. You got people in your streets you can shoot. Don't come over here. We got plenty of our own.
Well, there's so many parallels. You know, because I'm sure that if Israel's, I mean, they've already crossed the Lebanese border. You know, why are people saying, oh, will they invade? They invaded!
Well, you know, it's like with us in Iraq. They were like, you know, hell, we've already been into Syria and into Jordan. I mean, they just don't tell it a lot, but they know they've been across the borders. You know, some of these SEAL teams and all this, you know, they've been across the border. Heck, they've probably been further in than even they know.
Well, and it turns out I saw a press communique from the Mahdi army or the Shia army or, you know, one of those sects that exists.
Al-Sadr, they're one of his groups.
And they said, we are prepared to go and fight in solidarity side by side with our brothers of Hezbollah. And I thought, you know, you're going to have to fight through the American forces, and that would mean that you're in their rear. Oh, this is going to work real well. This is going to be good for us.
It gets to the point. It's like, how, you know, it's like, you know, what is the old thing? Programs. Can't tell who to shoot without a program.
Yeah. You know, and the story that I mentioned at the top of the hour, this is the Iraqis giving up on Iraq. This isn't the international community. This is them.
I know. Well, I mean, it's amazing how... Well, no, it's not amazing. I shouldn't say that. It's just par for the course.
And meanwhile,
our media has decided there is no Iraq anymore. No, we don't.
Well, I got a press release today from one of these right wing organizations that's forever wanting me to bring their weirdos on the show and waste my time talking to them. Ballyhooing the arrival of the Thank You America tour, Luke.
Oh God.
From the United Kurdistan Front for a United Kurdistan. See, they're calling it a country now. I mean, they're just now getting ready to...
Said if that happened, they'd come across the border, and they don't play nice.
No, but I mean, but that's the point. I mean, Turkey's got to be just loving this, because the Kurds are already calling themselves a country. As I've mentioned before on the show, the Kurds are the largest ethnic minority on planet Earth that do not have a country to call home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're about to, because they have named it. You know, they're not saying, you know... the Kurdistan province of Iraq. Oh, no. It's Kurdistan.
Well, you know, you remember, now, most people may have forgotten this, but, you know, when all this started, they had to go, you know, remember, they had to go through a whole bunch of negotiations with the Turks because they said, you know, said, if you all do this, we're coming across the border, said, because you ain't going to do it. Because they said, because they know that when the Kurds start doing it, they're going to take, like, the lower third of Turkey. I mean, they claim as Kurdistan.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it doesn't get better. No. It never gets better. And so when I hear these timetable freaks, Luke, you know, timetable for what? Timetable for when it gets really bad? Yeah, it's already really bad. Let's go. It's time to get out because we cannot be a part of any healing that takes place in that region. None. Nada. Nothing.
It's like I say, right now, our biggest achievement over there is we should pass out shirts with bullseyes on them just to save time. You know what I mean? It's
yeah,
like, that's what
isn't
we are.
Sad? Isn't it
I,
sad?
I wonder how many people, how many Americans are over there going, I'm Canadian, I'm Australian.
Oh, you know, our little mouth open, chewing, swearing like a sailor, German chancellor, groping president.
Oh,
yeah, we're turning a corner. The Tom Tomorrow cartoon was just wonderful today. Yeah, we're,
oh,
you know,
God.
Yeah. Are you a sunshiny conservative? Oh, God, I hate him. I used to say, you know, I have no hate in my heart for anybody. But, you know, I'm pretty much to where I do. And I might as well acknowledge it and come to terms with it and sort of clean my spirit up or whatever it is I'm supposed to do.
Well, it's like I said, I'm to the point now, I can occasionally stand one or two of the comedy bits, you know, off and on during the day, you know, Air America, somebody runs. But I'm to the point now, when I hear his voice, I just have to turn the sound off. Because you just want to scream.
Yeah, it's not Bush fatigue. It is a visceral illness. I think that, you know, that woman speaking in Australia, the Nobel laureate today, she gave voice, if not actual intent. We're sick. We are sick unto our souls of George Bush.
I forgot. I wanted to mention this before I forgot. Did you get the thing I sent you from Common Dreams? The guy the Fourth Estate had on, my mind's totally blank on his name, lives in Lebanon.
Oh, Robert Fisk, yeah.
Yeah, the article.
I did.
Okay.
It's...
I mean, here's somebody that you really should be talking to. You know what I mean? Most of the, you know, it's like these things with the mainstream. They ought to be talking to him. I mean...
Oh, no.
Right,
he's not...
Right,
he is
in front of it.
No, Luke, he is not allowed on American media because... Well, if you heard the interview on Fourth Estate, you understand why. Luke, I got to take a break. I'm a little bit late for it, but thank you so very much. You too.
I'll catch you later.
Bye now.
Bye.
We will come back to your phone calls post-haste, 877, the number 4, head on, 877-443-2366. Email comes into bob@headonradio.com. This is the Head On Radio Network. Oh, the crash test dummies. I'm Bob.
In the forest like a primate, using chopping tools instead of hot blades. Thumbing for a finger, supposed to show you're not a wild beast. You can hear the noises at night time. They don't have to keep a certain bedtime.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Despite some turbulence from the National Mediation Board, the union seeking to organize workers at JetBlue Airways has vowed to hold steady. The International Association of Machinists is seeking to organize the airline's 1,300 ground crew and crew members. The board ruled against the union, citing a lack of interest from employees. Under the ruling, the union must now wait 12 months before filing a new petition. In an email to employees, JetBlue CEO David Neeleman and President Dave Barger both expressed that the ruling was positive news for the airline. The union is also seeking to organize the company's flight attendants and customer service employees.
The United Steelworkers Union is hard at work at the bargaining table at Michelin BF Goodrich, working toward a master contract that can essentially also be applied to 20,000 workers at Goodyear and at Bridgestone. The union granted a 48-hour extension on the contract as negotiators work toward a Wednesday deadline to reach a new agreement. USW spokesperson Wayne Ranick says these are tough negotiations with cheap overseas labor markets threatening U.S. tire production. The USW's main issues are health care, pensions, and investments to keep U.S. plants operating.
What we're trying to do is get the investments necessary to enable the workers in our plant to produce the higher end, higher margin, higher quality tires that they can earn a North American wage that's in accordance to our standard of living, and yet the company can still be able to sell these tires in this marketplace and make a profit.
Ranick says after working with Goodyear to return the company to profitability, management is nevertheless again seeking concessions from the USW. Goodyear's pension system is underfunded by hundreds of millions of dollars. Ranick says the Goodyear talks will also be difficult.
Workers at Latrobe Brewing accepted a contract offer this weekend while hoping that their company's new owners will keep their jobs in the state. The Pennsylvania-based Latrobe has been purchased by Wisconsin-based City Brewing Company, and the workers, represented by the Industrial Division of the Communication Workers of America, are worried that the 170 jobs will be cut or moved. Reaching the two-year labor agreement was one of the final steps to completing the sale. here is today's economic report. You worked hard for that bachelor's degree, so why has it been 4 years since you received a raise? Wage stagnation is on the rise in the United States, with earnings for employees with bachelor's degrees dropping by 5.2% between 2000 and 2004, when adjusted for inflation. Those are numbers released by economists for the White House, and could be one possible reason that the president has low approval rating when it comes to handling the economy.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're back, and I'm not telling you what time it is. Let's go straight to the phones. David is calling from Middle Tennessee, somewhere near Nash Vegas. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Bob, and yes, indeed, I am near Nash Vegas, and we're very glad the heat wave has abated. And, you know, it's just been summer, and we're all thrilled about that.
Yeah, you're not breathing through the sponge anymore.
No, it's not one of those... What would we have? 9 days, the lowest temperature was 92, and the lowest humidity was 85%?
We had some of that, and it was awful.
It's tough to get that to stay in the mountains, or go to the mountains, I should say. But, you know, at 600 feet above sea level, it can be right here. But let's go back about 4 years. We had all the Republicans. We had them telling us that, you know, within 2 weeks there'll be gas tax on every neighbor from Saddam Hussein, and the next thing you know, Colin Powell goes to the UN, ruins his reputation, smears a great record as a soldier, causes us all to believe that within a month there'll be a nuclear weapon.
This is not speculation. These are facts. Remember that? I remember that.
Yeah, all right. So, boom. Congress, you know, eats it and smiles, and there we go. Well, you know, a year later, no weapons of mass destruction, nothing resembling a nuclear capability. Well, the little chimp stands up, wiggles his ears, and says, the reason we did this, he was a very bad guy.
He's a bad man.
He's, you know, he could have never said the phrase evil incarnate because he couldn't have understood the definition if it were explained to him. So the big thing was we've toppled the evil guy, and when we find him, we're going to make him pay. I haven't heard anybody say much about this, but for two... Oh, wow, Agnes nearly needed the button. I had one loaded up right then. Two darn years, Saddam has been on trial. And what, I say again, what has it come to? Three defense lawyers have been killed by the insurgency that the U.S. government says doesn't exist. It's really a civil war. Saddam is enough of a feisty character to have not taken... anything other than coffee with a little milk in it for 2 weeks. He's now being, quote, very quietly, and I haven't heard anybody say a word about it. He's being fed through a tube at the hospital. Nobody voluntarily gets fed through a tube. You're either sedated completely so you don't know what's going on, or there's a couple of guys strap you to a board. This is rubber hose up the nose.
Well, this is the only. Yeah,
I'm sorry?
No, David. This is the United States' only way out.
So today they had the trial again. No defense lawyers. Saddam's in a hospital somewhere. the, you know, a size 28 French, you know, colonic hose up his nose, giving him oatmeal, and we're calling that a success. And now then, the same guys that brought us this little piece of reality want to take on Iran, want to tell Syria what to do. Please, America, please look back on these lies. Let's not, you know, enough people have talked about the horror, and I don't say that in any jest, and I want to make sure I put some distance between any sort of over-the-top description. What is going on in South Lebanon is a horror. 600,000 people have been displaced. Nine-year-olds have their fingers blown off because there might have been a guy with a rocket in their apartment building. And in Iraq, this great noble cause is reduced to Saddam Hussein being fed with a tube crammed down his throat and all of his lawyers being killed by the civil war that rages in the country. I heard the phrase earlier, yes, the Iraqis have given up on Iraq. An American general right there is saying today, if we don't do something about security, we've got to devote more troops to security within Baghdad. Baghdad is the key to all of it. Well, you know, nobody that's American's been outside their little green zone. There's 1,000 people a month going to the Baghdad morgue. And
3,000 last month, David.
Oh. And no one in America should pay any attention. They should vehemently vote against anyone who's had anything to do with us being there, or I should say, with anyone going there, being there now, or staying there past sundown tomorrow. If anybody quibbles about us just leaving it alone, we are no longer any possibility of a solution in Iraq. We are any kind of problem you want to ask about. And yet now those same people want us to let them, what, take on Iran?
Backtracking just a little bit, I'm reminded of the story of Jeb Stuart's cavalry escapade through Pennsylvania and showing up late for Gettysburg.
Yep.
And you know how it is. Southerners remember this stuff like it was yesterday.
That's what we are.
And he shows up late. You know, Lee was blind. Part of the reason Gettysburg happened was Lee was blind. And as a consequence, Jeb Stuart shows up and says, look at all these cool wagons and supplies and stuff I got you. And Lee says, sir, they are an impediment to me now. We are an impediment now. We are strictly and purely and entirely, David, in Iraq, an impediment to anything that could remotely be considered in the line of peace, reconciliation, the parsing out Iraq. There is nothing. You're absolutely right. There is nothing that can happen there about which we will not be a problem instead of a solution.
It is our fault. We broke it. It's ours. We went there.
Pottery Barn.
If we could just roll the clock back, think potentially how much we could have accomplished if we had limited troops on the ground to, say, 40,000 and they never left Afghanistan. Accurately placed with the speed that America can move troops these days, we might have had, you know, that Bush cousin, that bin Laden guy. We might have had them. We would have certainly stood a greater chance.
Yeah, and
Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Cold, hard fact. Bush wanted that. Wolfowitz wanted that.
Pearl, Cheney, Rumsfeld, oh yeah.
All they think about is to stir that pot because they believe that nothing has come from an attempt at ceasefire and stability. Therefore, we should just stir it up and then step in once it's all really in a mess and we can be the victors. Well, guess what? It's not working out that way. And 2,600+ of our fine young men and women are dead. 30,000+ are maimed. 100 to 150,000 Iraqis are dead or crippled. The country is in a hell of a mess. I don't think there would have been this crap with Lebanon and Israel had we not destabilized the entire Middle East with this thing, with this Iraq invasion.
Well, and again, bear in mind what I noted talking to Luke. The Shia are now officially the Shia army, the Shia militia. You know, right. The militia that numbers in its
one that says,
thousands.
One that says yes, sir, to the solder fellow.
Yeah, they're in our rear now.
Oh, yeah.
They're not on our flank. They're behind us.
And did you hear about his little letter to his faithful today that has been authenticated?
No.
Short version. Gloves are off. We're tired of it. We have no reason to not kill 1,000 of anyone that has offended us or any one of ours that has died.
Gee, that sounds like a declaration of war to me, David.
The mayor of Sadr City, because I cannot remember his proper title, but I mean no disrespect, but that Sadr fellow is way pissed off.
Muqtada.
Thank you.
Muqtada al-Sadr. Yeah. And again, they're in our rear.
They're in our rear while we're looking every other direction. Oh, boy.
You know, after... Boy, I guess you bring out the perspective in me, David. After Pearl Harbor, we did everything but draw and quarter the Army and Naval commanders at Pearl Harbor.
This is Kimmel and Short.
Yes. At what point, and you know, it's the eternal question you have to ask, David, because you're dealing with a Bush administration. I know. At what point, you know, you can put Pepto-Bismol in a shot glass and it's a little more tolerable. At what point do we call these incompetent goofs, these murderous clowns with stars on their shoulder boards, to account?
I don't blame them so much as the civilian authority over them.
Well, no. I mean, it goes without saying that Rumsfeld, needs to be in a dock in The Hague. You don't get the fancy hardware on the shoulder boards without some responsibility coming along with it. Are these guys on the ground? Are they just marking time until they show up on CNN and Fox as news analysts, military affairs analysts? Is that what it is? Is that how the military works now? You just screw up until you, because at some point, David, at some point, that whole duty, honor, country thing kicks in. And at some point, duty means standing up to Donald Rumsfeld, who is crazier than a sprayed roach, and saying, look, I'll take my lumps, but I'm not going to get any more of my boys killed.
So many of those men and potentially women want that, you know, they want to move up from that silver one to the gold one, and they want to move up from one star to two stars, and rather than bars, they want an oak leaf cluster, and et cetera, et cetera.
But so, apparently you get that in the United States military now by shutting up, sitting down, and being quiet.
But the headroom between saying something and just simply towing the line, there's very little room left. Everything Murtha has said, everything that I can read, And you know, I was never in the military, but I brushed up against it for a good while. Those guys are getting really tired. I think if a single full colonel or above broke the line, there would be there would be a total cast. There would be an avalanche. If an active duty on the ground guy finally broke the line and said, look, boys, you know, I'm telling Stars and Stripes right now, this is it. I've had it. I'm hitting the BS button on this one for the world to know about it. There would be an avalanche of that sort of thing. So, yes, it could happen. It's closer than it's ever been. I think at any other time in U.S. military history, certainly the things I've read about. And it needs to be, because there are things going on right now that are utterly foolish, that are deadly to truth. And we've warned the military then. The ugliest part of this story is that in the continental United States, there are training units that aren't training because there is shortage of ammunition.
There's shortage of trainers.
There are shortages of trainers. There are literally shortages of ammunition and equipment.
The weevils are in the seed, David.
I'm sorry?
The weevils are in the seed.
You got it. It's utterly, utterly horrible, but yet this crowd that has worked so hard to kill the U.S. government and replace it with the Republican National Committee, and that's a fact of life, so that they can become, just like in Stalinist time, to drive the Republican Party is to drop the Republican. They just want to be the party. Whether you're a lobbyist, an appointee, an elected official, a school board member, you've got to go through a screening process that you swear allegiance to the Republican, to the party. Never mind America. America doesn't matter to these people right now. It's the party.
First, foremost, and always. We are, no, I keep saying it, we're at a crossroads. We're in a crisis of leadership. We lack leadership in the military. We lack political leadership. Bless his pea-picking heart. I'm glad you took me here, David. Bless his pea-picking heart. Dennis Kucinich came out with a plan for peace over the weekend.
Good for him.
There I was on Wednesday or Thursday saying, you know, where's Dennis Kucinich? Where's Dennis Kucinich? There was Dennis Kucinich with more leadership in a six-paragraph press release than Dear Leader has shown in 5 years.
The only thing Dear Leader can lead us to, were it in the context of a corporate boardroom, would be the biggest HR suit, would be the biggest sexual harassment suit in the history of employment in the United States. I finally saw enough of the visual representation of what he did to poor old Andrea Merkel. No real fan of Merkel here.
No, she's kind of a right winger.
Somebody on your show said, well, I forget where it was, but somebody said in relation to the visual of her being groped from behind by him, that was not her happy face when her hands were in the air. That woman, she had the creeps. It was like, get your hands off of me, you slimy.
Well,
villain.
Heavens to Betsy, the only people who are less tolerant of having their personal space invaded than the Germans are quite possibly the Swedes. You know, you're in their personal space when you're 30 feet away.
I don't know much about the Swedes, but I know Germans are like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't mean to make blanket statements, but yeah, it's personal integrity is big.
Well, they're that way because they view that personally. They will not bother you. If they bother you, they do it for a singular purpose: to accuse, to insult, to demean, and to defeat you.
Yeah, and it's 5 feet away. I should have gone, there's nobody giving out lessons. I mean, knife and fork school for Dear Leader, for God's sakes.
When I finally, and I was days behind in realizing what a mess he had made of that, that's like something you would have seen, you know, if suddenly the junior home ec class had to have a yearly planning meeting in the football letter club room, and suddenly three of the jocks walked in. That's exactly what that looked like.
And that's where and David, that's where that mind is. We're out of time. We got to hit the news, brother.
Well, I appreciate the chance to rant, but please, America, wake up, go to the polls, vote the bastards out, would you?
And all God's chillin' said amen.
Amen.
Thanks, Bob.
Later. All right, news break. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Quality News Network. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spoke with Lebanon's prime minister today in Beirut. She said Hezbollah must withdraw from southern Lebanon before a ceasefire can be called. But a Lebanese official later rejected their proposal. The conflict is now in its 13th day. Rice will meet tomorrow with Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. She's also scheduled to meet with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who's urging the U.S. to pressure Israel into stopping its offensive in Gaza City. On the Israel-Lebanon border, fierce fighting continued today with 8 civilian deaths in southern Lebanon. Israeli forces captured 2 Hezbollah guerrillas, and Hezbollah fired 90 rockets into Israel. 2 Israeli soldiers were killed in fighting, and 2 others died in a helicopter crash. U.S. officials say 12,000 Americans have now been evacuated from Lebanon. U.S. forces will now turn their attention to humanitarian efforts, including delivering supplies by U.S. helicopters and ships. But they won't be involved in delivering the supplies to Lebanon. In Gaza City today, Israeli strikes killed at least 3 Palestinians. The Israeli army says that came after the Palestinians fired 6 rockets into Israel. So far, more than 100 Palestinians and dozens of Israelis have been killed in the conflict. In Kabul, Afghanistan, hundreds of Taliban militants attacked a Western government building. 3 police officers were killed and 7 wounded. In Iraq today, 2 U.S. soldiers were killed as they fought death squads. At least 18 others were killed and 42 injured in various bomb and gun attacks across the country. In London today, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Al-Maliki said the country will not dissolve into civil war, despite the recent increase in violence, which the UN says is killing more than 100 Iraqis each day. Al-Maliki will meet tomorrow with President Bush in Washington, D.C. to discuss additional troops in Iraq. In Washington, Democrats say they will fight John Bolton's appointment as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. President Bush appointed him on a temporary basis last year. A Senate committee is expected to hold a confirmation hearing on Thursday. In the North Pacific Ocean, members of the U.S. Coast Guard and Air Force are trying to rescue 22 crew members from a sinking ship, which appears to be leaking oil. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Business news is next.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
Global trade talks in Geneva fell apart today after leading countries failed to agree on opening up farm and manufactured goods trade. A group of investors has announced plans to purchase HCA Incorporated, the largest for-profit hospital chain in the U.S., in a $21 billion deal. HCA was founded by the family of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. And Advanced Micro Devices is buying ATI Technologies in a more than $5 billion deal. The parent company of United Airlines is expected to post its first profit since 2000, its UAL's first full quarter out of bankruptcy. Australian mental health scientists have developed a pill that could stop or slow the onset of Alzheimer's disease. Human trials will begin in September. Merck says its second quarter profit more than doubled. That's due to profits from its cholesterol medication and other prescription drugs. AOL is expected to offer more of its services for free, including email accounts. The Time Warner Board will review AOL's proposals, which aim to increase advertising. Meanwhile, AOL founder Steve Case told an interviewer that he's sorry for the 2001 merger with Time Warner. Light Sweet Crude settled at $75.05 today. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow was up 183 points at 11,051. NASDAQ up 41, S&P 500 up 21. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Did you hear that? $21 billion. I don't know. Maybe you do the Dr. Evil thing with the little finger in the corner. $21 billion. $21 billion. That's what, how much the cat killer family is going to get for selling out its crappy little HCA hospitals. Yes, you?
Dr. Evil, it's already been done. How many times has it changed hands, but yet he still seems to be involved?
Well, you know, you got to keep your hands on the money when you got to, you know, when you want to be the fundamentalist nominee for president.
Oh, you mean the hospital that does legal abortions?
Lots and lots.
And he practiced on how many kitty cats that he got from the shelter?
Meow.
Meow. Yeah. Bad man. Very bad man.
Yes, dear. Bill Frist is a very bad man. You heard it here first. $21 billion. Spend it all on the campaign, Bill. Spend every last blessed dime. We want you to. Because you know what? You're still going to be a freak. You can put lipstick on a pig, but it is still going to oink when you're dancing. There's no getting around it. Bill Frist is a freak. The cat thing just blows me away. But $21 billion. You know where they got them. How many times has Healthcare Corporation of America been just dinged for criminal welfare fraud? No, not welfare fraud. Medicare, Medicaid fraud. How many times? A couple that I know of. Unless I'm thinking about the same case, but they got hammered. Just $21 billion. How far would $21 billion take us on health care for every American? Every American. You know, not just the poor ones. Not just the old ones. Not just the young ones. Every American. How far would $21 billion take us? Long way down the road, don't you reckon? Mighty long way down the road. An email in from our friend Sue on Big Coal River. She reports on CNN they claim that a doctor treating the wounded says that the wounded have suffered burns that look and smell like the Israelis are using white phosphorus. Israel, of course, denies this. Sue notes, I would imagine these doctors know what they're talking about. Me too, Sue. Me too. But I said earlier in the program that I went running around because I had one of those little brain worms that was sort of boring into the one of the backs of my lobes because Colonel John M. Chivington. This is our history lesson for the evening. Colonel John M. Chivington. The date is November 29th, 1864. And there's a village of Cheyenne and Arapaho Native Americans. And the leader of that group is a man by the name of Black Kettle. And he thought he had made himself a deal with the regular army. He was flying, among other things, an American flag from his dwelling. Enter Colonel John M. Chivington, a member of the Colorado Volunteers, not a member of the regular army, 3 months away from having most of his men's enlistments expire, descends upon the settlement led by Black Kettle. Now, Black Kettle and his men were out on a hunting party when Colonel John M. Chivington arrived at the village. Colonel Chivington, who wanted a battle before his men's enlistment was up. He descended upon that village where Black Kettle's dwelling flew an American flag and a white flag of truce. And there, when he arrived, there were no warriors, no braves, no chiefs, no fighting men, just the women and the children and the sick and the elderly. And on November 29th, 1864, Colonel Chivington of the Colorado Volunteers and his militia deliberately and indiscriminately slaughtered, massacred, mutilated over 100 women and children, as well as the elderly in the village. He never went to trial. His order to his men, quote, kill and scalp all, big and little. Nits make lice. Kill and scalp all, big and little. Nits make lice. Bob, what the dickens has that got to do with anything? It's got everything to do with everything. Honest to God, it does. From the Associated Press, via Bart Cop, 4 U.S. soldiers accused of murdering suspected insurgents during a raid in Iraq say they were under orders to, quote, kill all military-age males, unquote, according to their sworn affidavits. The soldiers first took some of the men into custody because they were using 2 women and a toddler as human shields. They shot 3 of the men after the women and child were safe and say the men attacked them. The rules of engagement was to kill all military-age males on Objective Murray, Staff Sergeant Raymond L. Gerard, told investigators, referring to the target by its code name. The target, an island on a canal in northern Salahuddin province, was believed to be an Al-Qaeda training camp. The soldiers said officers in their chain of command gave them the order and explained that special forces had tried before to target the island that had come under fire from insurgents. Gerard, Specialist William B. Hunsaker, Private First Class Corey R. Claggett, and Specialist Justin R. Graber, charged with murder, other offenses relating to the May 9th raid and the shooting of three men. They're also charged with obstruction of justice because it is alleged that they threatened to kill another soldier if he broke the code of silence, the Omerta. Now, all these soldiers say that they were ordered to attack the town on the island on May 9th. They're all four from Fort Campbell, Kentucky's 3rd Battalion, 187th Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division. Jesus, the 101st. They are mounting a defense that they were only following orders. Their defense lawyer says, quote, they did their job honorably, they did it admirably. If they did want to kill these men, they could have been within the rules of the engagement. Did you catch what they say the order was that they were only following? Kill all military-aged males. Why not just add nits make lice? Nits make lice. Colonel John M. Chivington.
What is the military-aged males?
Well, right. Exactly, Agnes. Exactly. See? Over there, what the hell is a military-aged male? Four, we've killed four-year-old little boys. Six, we've killed six-year-old little boys. Eight, we have killed eight-year-old little boys. We have killed our fair share of 10-year-old little boys. 12-year-old little boys. At what age, in this circumstance, is an Iraqi child capable of handling a Kalashnikov, an AK-47, a weapon? Kill all military-aged males. Nits make lice.
Do you remember the picture way, way back where the person from the army was standing with the two little boys and the sign that said, I killed their father and I knocked up their sister?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
And then there's Haji Girl.
How old were those children? Would they be considered military age males?
Well, heck, if that's the rules of engagement, then all the bombs we've dropped on civilian targets, the pregnant women that we have slaughtered in Tomahawk cruise missile attacks.
I think one point needs to be made clear, though, is that the military, the personnel, are not bad. There are a few that are bad, that gives bad names to everyone else.
Well,
the soldiers need to be brought home.
These four guys, yeah, they need to be brought home, but these four guys are bad, okay?
Yeah, they're bad. No doubt.
Because when you get to the point where you're mounting the I was only following orders defense, we said in 1946, 1947, 1948, we said that I was only following order is not a defense to a war crime. And here we are abrogating our own rules.
Didn't they watch A Few Good Men and learn anything from that?
No.
They seem to be watching a lot of TV and movies.
No, dear. because, you know, I mean, you kind of hoo-ah the Jack Nicholson character in there.
Not really.
Turns out that Jack Nicholson character in A Few Good Men would appear to be representative of, if what these guys are saying is true, some higher-ups in the 101st. Kill all military-aged males.
Is it like the firstborn son type deal out of Pharaoh?
Nits make lice, but that's not the end of it. No, no, no. No, no. We'll take a break, and we'll pick this up on the other side. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
On the web you can go that's so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Claude, Wally, and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. So stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com, your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
And I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried.
Hello?
Louise, it's Ralph. Listen, would you go out with me tomorrow?
At 8? Ralph, I'd love to.
Well, I have an appointment with my orthopedic surgeon, and I really want you to come along.
A doctor's office? That's so special. Oh, I just remembered I have to delete some emails.
Come on, Louise. We're going to talk about the pain in my hip, and I could use a little support.
I guess I'm not very hip.
You could take notes and help me remember stuff. Look, I have all my doctor questions written down, but there's so much to remember. I need you there with me so I don't miss anything.
Couldn't we just play miniature golf?
Louise, I'm not asking for a kidney.
Bringing someone to your appointment is a good way to make sure you and your physician are on the same page. The idea is to partner with your doctor and share information so you can make informed decisions together. For more on patient-doctor communications, visit orthoinfo.org, a message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, where patient-centered care means getting better together.
like I said, that wasn't where the story ended. These are, you know, these are affidavits. It was only once the men moved to the northern half of the island that they found anyone, Gerard said. He said he and others shot and killed a man they spied in a window in one building and then rushed into a house where they'd found three other men hiding behind two women. A fifth man holding a two-year-old girl in front of him later came out of another building, Gerard and Hunsaker told investigators. Gerard said the four surviving men were not immediately killed because of the human shields. Once the women and child were moved to safety, he told investigators, the men did not appear to pose a threat, and the soldiers took them into custody. But then the men attacked him while they were trying to put the plastic ties on them for handcuffs. Quote, I had felt this action necessary, for they had tried to use deadly force on me and my comrade. Hunsaker said he was stabbed. Claggett said he was struck on the face with a fist or something. Now, after the men were dead, they said they found some AK-47s. Of course, everybody in Iraq has an AK-47. My God, what have we gotten these young men into? Bad things, man. Bad things. Lots of bad things. This is not hard to fathom. This is not tough to figure out. They must come home. Every American soldier in Iraq must come home. Not on a timetable. Not sometime 6 months from now. They must come home. It must begin ASAP. And the sooner that it does, the sooner that poor, bloodied, beaten, bedraggled, bombed, blasted, raped, murdered, slaughtered, massacred land will begin to heal. This is not rocket science. The healing does not begin until there is not a single American left on Iraqi soil. And frankly, when they do split up the country into South Screwdistan and North Buggerdistan and Kurdistan, then the real fun is going to start, and I don't think we want to be there in the middle of it. You ever seen a guy walk into a brawl between a couple of drunks? Now, I'm not comparing the Iraqis to drunks. Stop it. Okay, they're not drunk. They're just really excited. You ever seen a guy walk into a brawl between two people? What happens to the guy who's in the middle of the brawl? The two guys who were fighting suddenly realize they've got a common enemy and they stomp the snot out of the... Yeah. This does not end well for us. There is not a scenario in which this ends well. The only thing that we can take away from this is the idea that we got out in time to save a few American lives and keep the American military from being utterly and irretrievably destroyed. Is it so hard to understand? Is it? Not to me. So we'll take a break. And we'll come back and we'll finish out the program. Your thoughts or my thoughts. It's entirely up to you. The phone number you know, 877-443-2366. 877, the number 4, head on. And I'm Bob.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today may not be around for our children and grandchildren. All the new technology in the world can't create more sky over our heads or new oceans. The Earth's natural resources, fresh water, land, and even the air we breathe are limited. Voluntary family planning improves the health of women and their children. It also helps slow population growth, which is good for our planet. So help ensure that people everywhere have access to the information and services they need to plan their families and help build a healthy future for us all. Population Action International is working to promote voluntary family planning around the world. Visit us at www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
I'm a new mother. My baby and I are healthy and happy. But I was shocked to learn that every minute a woman somewhere in the world dies in pregnancy or childbirth. When women can't plan when to get pregnant, or even how many children to have, it puts them and their babies at risk. We can lower these risks for just pennies a day. I'm proud that our government supports programs that help mothers and their families around the world. If you are too, call your U.S. Senators and Representative today at 202-224-3121 and tell them you support U.S. assistance for voluntary family planning programs worldwide. That's 202-224-3121. For the cost of the pennies we see lying on our sidewalks, we can make a real difference. This message brought to you by Population Action International.
Guy James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Can never last. Wake me up when September ends. Like my father's.
26 minutes before the hour. I'm Bob. This is Head On. Man, is it so good to be back with you and chatting again with Monday upon us. Our friend Andy wrote in from the Netherlands to say that he was all for my idea of getting rid of Sundays, too. Call it non-day. And make it sort of an extension of Saturday. That would work. That would work. All right. Two more. From the New York Times today. Muntaha Shaito's eyes rolled back as the paramedics screamed at her to stay awake and implored her son Ali to keep her engaged as she teetered near death from shrapnel wounds inflicted by an Israeli rocket. "Pray to God," one paramedic shouted at her as she writhed in Ali's arms. "Don't go to sleep, Mama. Look at me," Ali shouted, tears streaking his bloodied face. "Don't die. Please don't die." And Hassan M. Fatah, writing for the New York Times, says, "It was the scene that members of the extended Shaito family said they had feared most, the reason they had held out for days in their village of Tire, in southern Lebanon. Tired of the Israeli bombardment, but more terrified of what might happen if they risked leaving. On Sunday, they gave up their stand, and all 18 members crammed into the family's white Mazda minivan. They planned to head north toward the relative safety of Beirut. Within minutes, they became casualties of Israel's 12-day-old bombardment of southern Lebanon, which the Israelis say they will continue indefinitely to destroy the military abilities of Hezbollah. An Israeli rocket, which Lebanese officials said was likely fired from a helicopter, slammed into the center of the Shaito's van as it sped round a bend a few miles west of their village, and the van crashed into a hillside. Three occupants were killed, and Uncle Mohammed, the grandmother Nazira, and a Syrian man who had guarded their home. The missile also critically wounded Mrs. Shaito and her sister. 11 others suffered less severe wounds. Musba, Shaito, another uncle, said, "They said leave, and that's what we did." His niece, Heba, 16, cried hysterically behind him for her dead father, whose head was blown almost completely off. This reporter watched as paramedics struggled to remove the dead from the van, but soon gave up as an Israeli drone hovered overhead. Mr. Shaito said, "This is what we got for listening to them. They came from a farming village. It was known for raising tobacco, for raising citrus, for raising olives. Do you remember Colonel John Chivington? What was flying from the home of Chief Black Kettle when his men descended upon the village and slaughtered those Native Americans wholesale? A white flag. A white flag was flying from Black Kettle's home when, having given the order, kill and scalp all, big and little, mitts make lice, a white flag was flying. As they drove away from their homes, the Shaito family waved a white flag from their minivan, trying to signify to Israeli aircraft that they were no threat. Oh, Of course, the Israeli military said that they had targeted approximately 20 vehicles suspected of serving the terror organization in the launching of missiles at Israel and were recognized fleeing from or staying at missile launching areas. Nits make lice. Nits make lice. Then there are the Zabads, who, driving away, spotted a wounded man on the road, stopped and picked him up. They picked up two more men who had been attacked on a motorcycle. Their friends, the Surur's Mercedes sedan, was then hit by a missile. Mohammed Surur, the father, Darwish Madili, a relative, were each hit and killed. Mohammed's son, Mahmoud, 8 years old, was burned to the point that he will never have anything approaching a normal life. Kill all, scalp all, nits make lice. Let us go to the phones. Ben joins us from Elgin, Illinois. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Bob.
How are you?
I don't know. Especially after hearing that.
I don't either. I don't either. They were told, you know, the people of southern Lebanon have been presented, Ben, with what I was taught a long time ago is a Hobson's choice.
Yep.
They are leafleted and told to leave their homes as they were in Marwahin. And when they leave their homes, they are rocketed on the road on the way out.
Well, you know, those white minivans, those are known terrorists. Vehicle.
Well, yeah, you know, and those Mercedes-Benz sedans and those motorcycles and those Nissan Sport utility vehicles. Oh, well, ambulances. Yeah, yeah, those are known terrorist vehicles.
You know, if this weren't happening, the big news would be what's about to happen to our people in the green zone.
Which is?
AP had a story over the weekend that we expect to have about 10,000 insurgents descending upon Baghdad in the next few days. For there to be major new fighting and for the Green Zone to be a target. And I think there's an entire possibility.
Is there an Arabic word for Tet?
There should be. I think there's a possibility the Green Zone is going to get cut off. There is really one major road out of there. The rest of it all goes, you know, all the other roads. There's that big road that goes from the Green Zone straight west to the Saddam Hussein airport. Okay? The big airport. There are smaller roads that leave the area, but those are all, you know, not terribly straight, okay, as roads in old cities are not.
Right.
And they go through mixed urban areas where there could be a sniper around every corner, where there's lots of cover. And if the insurgents, if 10,000 of them do materialize and do move in to Baghdad in the next couple weeks, it's entirely possible that they could make the express roads to the airport into a choke point and render it unusable to us, at which point the only option we're going to have to resupply the Green Zone is going to be using helicopters and Ospreys, okay, which the insurgents already do know how to shoot down. And if that happens, I think we're going to be hard-pressed to evacuate the civilians.
Well, at this point, I'm beginning to wonder, as we look at the developments of Iraq, I'm beginning to wonder, Ben, whether these generals, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to, you can't blame this on a staff sergeant.
No.
You can't blame this on an E-1 or an E-2. I'm beginning to wonder if the generals who were over there got us into this, can you still win general stars playing skee ball at the amusement park?
Well, you know, that's been a problem with the American military between wars for years. When we entered World War II, we hardly had a general worth the gunpowder it would have taken to blow him out of existence. Okay? We had a very few. We had General Patton. We had General Eisenhower. I don't even think Eisenhower was actually a general yet at the beginning of the war.
We had MacArthur. We had Marshall. We had...
That was it.
Bradley.
Well, Bradley was a colonel.
Yeah, Bradley got bumped.
Okay? And Marshall was a colonel. Fulbert colonel. Okay?
Wow. Okay.
The people who were actually in charge, you know, the three stars and the admiral, especially the admiral, were useless. I mean, if you look at our defense against U-boats off the East Coast at the beginning of Operation Kugelschlag, you know, Operation Drumbeat,
mm-hmm.
we had nothing. We had nothing. The Germans showed up off our shores and found our shores lit up, our navigational beacons on, and all the ships running their lights. And it was like a shooting gallery. You know, there was absolutely no problem in expending all of your torpedoes in the limited amount of time your fuel let you remain there and making every one of them count. And they did. And the reason was because we had absolutely no leadership coming from the Navy at the beginning of that war.
I mean, Ben, we are at zero.
Yeah.
Or quite possibly, given the negligence, the gross negligence, the willful wanton conduct involved, we may well be at less than zero.
Here's the deal. You have to look at all the people who have resigned their commission. A lot of the general staff left. They saw what was coming.
Sure.
They wouldn't have any part of it.
Abizade is a political appointment.
Right.
Ricardo Sanchez, political
right.
appointment. These guys are not fit to lead a Cub Scout pack out of the parking lot, let alone one of the premier militaries on the face of planet Earth.
And it shows at every level of the chain of command.
Frankly, I think Peter Pace is probably a hack. And I hate to say that about a Marine.
Well, you know, even in the military, there is such a thing as your Peter promotion.
Oh, yeah. Rising to the highest level of his own inefficiency.
That's right. You know, I mean, you do really, really well as a full bird colonel, and they say, son, we're gonna make you a general. And they do it. And all of a sudden, you know, you realize, hey, I've got no idea what a general does. I've just been following orders all these years.
You know, I've run out recently. Not run out. It's just right here on the shelf, Ben. But I've decided to pick up and reread Catch-22.
Good book.
And I'm thinking, you know, for those who have read it, if you haven't, you should. Applicable now as it ever was, and it was plenty applicable when it came out, but we are up to our necks in General Dreedles.
We sure are.
And Colonel Cathcarts. And Colonel Moodus.
Yep.
Clowns. Utter, inept, political hack clowns.
Exactly right.
I mean, if you're any kind of a field commander, Ben, and I guess I'm guilty at this point of Monday morning quarterbacking or Monday evening quarterbacking, whatever. But if you're any kind of a commander, how do you look at what you have on the ground in Iraq and not just have the hair, you know, the short little hairs on the back of your neck stand straight up and pick up the phone and call Peter Pace or who the hell ever or Donald Rumsfeld and, you know.
I think that the guys who have done that wound up being told that their services were no longer required.
But, I mean, some of these guys are on the ground in Iraq, right?
Well, some of them are, and some of them have called and been told, you're no longer responsible for that. Just mind your orders. Or you're no longer responsible for that. We're transferring you stateside, and oh yes, you're retiring.
But Ben, what are the orders?
Well,
I mean,
the orders are these are horribly unwinnable ideas. Cooperate with the Iraqis military, unless the Iraqi military, doesn't do exactly what we tell them to, and keep the place occupied. We're fighting.
That's what you tell a kindergarten teacher. Yeah, keep them occupied.
You can't do it.
We're at 60-70% of the American people say that it wasn't a good idea to go into Iraq. At what point do we get to the 60-70% of the people say it's not a good idea to stay in Iraq? Do we have to have, our good friend Cossack in the headonradionetwork.com chat room just said, green zone equals DNBN foo.
Yes, it is like a lot like DNBN foo because, except for the fact that there are no hills surrounding it where you can dig in emplacements and use artillery, it is going to get cut off, and when it is cut off, it'll only be resupplyable by the air, and that is essentially an untenable position for any military. And there are the problem here is it is not just military in the green zone. There are diplomats in the green zone. There are contractors in the green zone. There are
mercenaries. There are
advisors in the green zone.
There are 50,000. Mercenaries all over Iraq. Them, I have a hard time getting worked up about.
Well, you realize, of course, that when we withdraw, that when we pull the American military out in a rout, which may happen soon in places, nobody evacuates them.
No.
Okay, they are left, they are hung out to dry.
They're the Lost Legion. Then
and I'm not entirely sure that some of them aren't going to start shooting back at us.
This is, and again, this is not complicated to figure out.
No. It's elementary military theory that you don't concentrate all your forces in an undefensible spot.
And you don't allow yourself to become encircled.
No, and, we picked the green zone very badly because it is already encircled on two sides by a river and on the other two sides by urban Iraq. The only real wiggle room in the whole place is there's a very large field of fire, which were the parade grounds and exhibition grounds for Saddam's regime. A huge park. Basically, the green zone is already surrounded by geography, and it is not going to take a whole lot in the way of insurgency and IEDs and mortar attacks and, a few key bridges and streets taken out before it is encircled in fact.
Yeah, but see, I can just about bet you, Ben, I know how these geniuses think. They think, we'll fly in some sorties from Kuwait, Qatar. We'll launch a few submarine-based Tomahawk cruise missiles, and that'll all be over with. We'll defeat them with that.
Well, that would work if you were talking about a conventional army. But we're talking a low-intensity conflict. We are talking an insurgency that has already infiltrated both the police and the armed forces of the country we think we are trying to hold and, where we think those forces are cooperating with us. I really believe that we will find out very quickly that entire units of police and entire units of the Iraqi army are really not loyal.
Well, the Kurds, I mean, you know, the Kurds have already said, I mean, they're on record. They have been interviewed, okay? They've been interviewed by journalists from all over the world, and they say, listen, the minute that it is to our advantage, we're taking the uniforms off, we're grabbing the guns, and we're going back to our Kurdistan army.
Exactly true, but fortunately for us, the Kurds are still not in Baghdad. But what we have in Baghdad, we have managed to arm and train a whole bunch of insurgents.
Somebody got some splaining to do, Ben.
It's a person I know on Democratic Underground who is an ex-SEAL, served in Vietnam, says that he gives the Green Zone 9 weeks. He thinks it'll be gone by the end of September.
I don't think they'll be able to... Well, never mind. I don't even want to contemplate it, Ben.
Anyhow, sir...
Suffice to say, Dover's going to be busy.
Oh, God. I didn't want to think about that.
Didn't get to that, did you?
No. I just didn't want to think about that.
And the drip, drip, drip of 3 Americans, 5 Americans, 11 Americans, 2 Americans... We have not seen the horror yet of our folly, Ben.
I'm afraid we're going to have the roosters come home really soon.
I hope you're wrong. I want you to be wrong.
I do, too. You take care, sir.
Have a good evening, Ben.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Please understand that. I want to be wrong. But I have no faith in the general staff of our military. None whatsoever. None at all. Thanks to everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Jeff Goodell. Get the book, Big Coal. Read it. You will enjoy it. You will be enlightened and perhaps inspired. And we are in a time in this country where inspiration is at a premium. The show tonight, of course, produced by my darling wife, Agnes, announced by Brian Reznor. Our chief engineer is John Fox in Sydney, Australia. Ben Birch, whom you just heard, manages our streams and our archives and podcasts at WhiteRoseSociety.org. He also manages the archives of a number of other great liberal talkers. Listen to Liz Brown some morning. She's awesome. Ben's got a fundraiser going on. Do the right thing. Help him out. Our IT professional is Peter Godbold of Godbold Computers in Tallahassee, Florida. Our news ninja is our good friend Gene from Portland, Oregon. Every program on the Head On Radio Network happens because of one primary factor, and that is thousands of members of the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights get up every day and go to work, and they build the American dream. And in so doing, they support the growth of this network, and they try to save the American dream. And always, 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 RMR, it's all for you.